Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod. I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School and Director of the Children's Policy Centre and the Poverty and Inequality Research Centre.
I'm Anna-Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and physician, and I'm part of the College of Health and Medicine here at the Australian National University. And Sharon, I'm very much looking forward to continuing the mini-series that we started last week.
I really enjoyed that conversation. Both Kristen and Warwick, you know, brought so much to our thinking about what's driving this crisis that we're currently finding. And, you know, some of the explanations that Warwick gave us around what is inflation, I think, are just so useful. Economists know exactly what they're talking about when they use those terms, but I think many of us don't really know what that means. And so in thinking about the cost of living crisis, what's happening around inflation, I think that episode just gave us some of the foundational thinking that we needed, but also went further than that in explaining the economic foundations that we have to work with. I think in this series we'll come back to what is inflation and perhaps also a bit of blue sky thinking about how we can start to do things differently. As our listeners know, Policy Forum Pod is based here at the Crawford School of Public Policy at the ANU. You can visit crawford.anu.edu/study to find out about some of the fantastic degree programs and short courses that we have on offer. So, Anna-Greta, as we said, today we're continuing this mini-series on the impacts of the cost of living and the inflation crisis, but we're doing a bit more of foundational thinking today about some of the real problems that this country faces and needs to resolve. Would you like to set the scene for this really important conversation we're about to have?
Absolutely. I'm struck again, and I know this is probably getting repetitive for many of us, that crisis often presents us with opportunity, and particularly opportunities for change and new ideas. Last week, we went back to basics with Warwick McKibben and Kristen Sobeck for us to understand the current global economic environment and how the war in Ukraine, the effects of the pandemic, the natural disasters, and an historic economic narrative bubbling since the global financial crisis in 2008 have all combined to put pressure on the cost of living today. In our second episode of the mini-series, we are seeking to explore and understand the impact of these pressures on First Nations people across Australia and the pathway forward for economic self-determination. Self-determination is a right where all people are free to pursue their economic, social and cultural development without outside interference. Without self-determination, today's guest explains that First Nations people will continue to be second-class citizens in Australia. Particularly as we are recording this show during NAIDOC Week, with the 2022 theme being Get Up, Stand Up, Show Up, in our current economic environment, how do we create systemic change that empowers an economic self-determination framework for Indigenous Australians? How can voice, treaty, and truth support in achieving this framework? And what are the pathways forward? So joining us today to explore these issues and more, we are joined by an inspiring, extraordinary leader from here at the Australian National University. Sharon, could you introduce our guest?
I would love to, Anna-Greta. We have with us today Peter Yu. And of course, Peter is an old friend of the pod, although we haven't spoken to him for quite some time. Peter is a Yawuru man from Broome in the Kimberley region of Australia. He has over 40 years of experience in Indigenous development and advocacy in the Kimberley at the state, national and international levels. Peter was a key negotiator on behalf of the Yawuru native title holders with the Western Australian state government over the 2010 Yawuru Native Title Agreement. He was until recently Chief Executive Officer of the Yawuru Corporate Group and is now, amongst the many titles that he holds, the inaugural Vice President of First Nations here at the ANU. Peter, welcome to the pod. It's fantastic to have you with us.
Thank you, Sharon. Thanks for inviting me.
So this episode is part of our mini-series where we're looking at the social impacts of the rising costs of living and of inflation. And in this mini-series, we're looking at the impacts on people across a number of areas, including health, poverty and housing. But Peter, I wonder if we could begin with me asking how the rising cost of living is impacting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, particularly in remote communities where we've seen some really shocking reports about the phenomenally high prices of the most basic goods.
The situation, I guess, is that people live in a very marginalised and impoverished position anyway. Largely, the dominant form of income, of course, is some form of welfare payment. While we're looking at the immediate issue of the cost of living and the hike, this is a kind of normal situation, particularly in most rural and remote communities. And I'd say even in the more urbanised environment as well too. I can't imagine it'd be all that much different. But it's relative in the sense that you're talking about enormous logistic costs of freight, transport, and other factors like that. So you already have a low income base. You already have an inflated price because of these logistical and other costs, transport costs. You also have this question of accessibility or connection, mainly largely to do with transport. So in the more remote and rural areas, of course, most of the food is probably flown in by freight or by truck. But then, of course, in urgent situations from time to time, and particularly during kind of times of crisis, I mean, with COVID and during the latter part of the year when roads get cut off by floods, supply is not guaranteed. And then, therefore, if it has to be flown in or by some other means, it then, of course, goes to another additional kind of level. I think fuel costs, you know, have, given the vast distances people have to travel to access services and other facilities, it's just really prohibitive in the sense that people can't afford. I suppose that how people get by is that they usually probably pool their money, whatever money they can get, if they need to go to town to buy supplies. Otherwise, if they're going to have to just rely on what's available in their local community store. I don't have details of what the price is, but I know, you know, like 5-10 years ago, you're already paying $5 for a lettuce. The real impact is really affecting, I would say, the kind of health and well-being of the communities. If you aren't able to access fresh vegetables and fruit and nutritious kinds of foods, then you're largely relying on falling back on the kind of, you know, pretty basic kind of diets, which is highly processed kind of foods, tin foods, and probably, you know, probably people flour, and a lot of people make damper and stuff out bush. But I think that it's unimaginable, and I really don't know how people do survive. I think there's some sense of genius in the way that people are able to manage that, but I would suggest under great difficulty.
Peter, what you've just described to us indicates so powerfully that while many Australians at the moment are really struggling with the cost of living crisis that we're seeing, that for many Indigenous Australians this isn't new. You know, you've talked about over many years the challenges that many people have faced. And how would you describe the economic situation of Indigenous Australians in our country today and of First Nations communities?
I don't think that we've advanced too far. I mean, obviously, there are some very good things that are happening from the point of view of the developing kind of educated class of Aboriginal people who are now going to finishing high school and going to universities and getting various degrees in particular professions. So, you know, there's a lot of doctors and lawyers. I don't know many economists or accountants, so I'm presuming that there are some people out there. So I think that and there are also people, of course, who are now buying their own homes. So there's an emerging, I guess, growth in the Aboriginal middle class, if I might put it in those terms. But largely the majority of people are excluded from the economy, Sharon, I would suggest, because we – a number of things. I think largely our lack of knowledge and engagement and experience in dealing in the economy. I think the fact that we've been – the marginalisation and the historical kind of reasons for that have continued to impact on that. I think the – while there are – resource agreements that have now happened between various traditional owner and native title groups and large corporate mining companies, that's far and few between in the context of the majority of Aboriginal people position. I think that the, you know, we're still very much, as I said before, there's a codependency relationship between the kind of government bureaucracy and programs and the way that people engage in their daily lives. So we have while we have an emergence and also emerging kind of entrepreneurial class of Aboriginal people as well in terms of small business and other businesses, that's growing. But I think that's all relative in terms of the kind of balance. There is a lack of equity, lack of level playing field, and not very much. A lot of the success has really been on the basis of Aboriginal people themselves taking the initiative and moving into business and getting things done themselves. That there hasn't been the kind of positive level of government intervention. There isn't the kind of fiscal equalisation, if you like, on a financial equalisation on a rational basis, where there are large groups of impoverished peoples with low incomes. You know, I think that that is something that needs to be considered in the future context of involving Aboriginal people in the local and regional and national economy. I think what we have in a post-native title and land rights era, native title determination and land rights era, we have a considerable asset base that has been accumulated over the last 30, 40, 50 years. But we still have a major issue of question of cash and access to capital. And so I think that's a major problem. I mean, in Northern Australia, you would venture to say something in the vicinity of 80-90%, if not more, of Aboriginal people have a direct or indirect interest in the land and other resource assets of Northern Australia. Nationally, it's roughly about 51-57%. But being able to activate those assets in a beneficial way to optimise some form of economic return is very limited at the moment. Notwithstanding, we have various social impact investing direction and the ESG considerations now, protocols that are being developed in regards to the standards required for investors and investment houses and major corporates. That hasn't yet translated into a kind of a measurable return, you would say, that engages Aboriginal people in the mainstream economy.
Peter, the economic situation of First Nations people in Australia really can't be separated from the history of genocide and dispossession and the ongoing process of colonisation. I'm wondering if you can talk us through those impacts for us.
Well, I mean, if you were looking at it from a purely economic point of view, I mean, notwithstanding the kind of the injustices perpetrated by, you know, mass killings and massacres and people dying of disease and being you know, deliberately hunted and shot off their land to pave the way for the advancement of the settler economy. If you were looking at purely from an economic point of view and looking at opportunity lost back to when first settlement occurred and the lack of engagement of First Nation communities and the original people in the economy from that first date, that's I'm not an economist, so what they would measure up to would be some considerable amount of money, I think. And you've had decisions like the Timber Creek decision in 2017, the High Court Timber Creek decision, Griffiths versus the Commonwealth, which added an additional dimension to the nature of the calculation of impact on native title lands that go beyond just the immediate land impact, but raises the question of the potential impact for cultural or cultural and social and other well-being matters that might have impacted as a result of the destruction or desecration of Aboriginal lands, special lands. So this is a an interesting challenge for the future in terms of the economists and the kind of people, the numbers people, as to what will likely be the context and criteria and setting for a compensation claim between Aboriginal people and Australia, the Australian nation state, as to what, how do we view, A, the kind of lost opportunity, how do we view, A, that in the context of compensation and you know, see how is that dealt with from the point of view of restorative justice. I think there are interesting questions. I mean, we've had a number of different inquiries happening about the stolen wages, let alone compensation for the stolen generation. I think there's a hearing happening in West Australia at the moment about stolen wages where people basically were treated as slaves and were not actually paid their due entitlements in terms of the value of their work and their output. So Aboriginal people, you know, have contributed to the establishment of major industries throughout the history of settlement, but have not been adequately compensated. So in every kind of situation, there's been a deliberate attempt to undermine the nature of appreciating the value of Aboriginal people's contribution and to the economy. And of course, the worst way possible of that is to exclude people from the economy. I think I've raised an example on a number of occasions where I think it's a living example today where we have in the Pilbara, which is the epicenter of wealth generation through the export of the iron ore, and in the middle of that, and it's also, of course, drives the economic, it's the economic powerhouse of the nation as far as contribution to the kind of fiscal and financial well-being of the country. But in the middle of that is in Roebourne is a prison with the majority of Aboriginal faces, and it's hard to juxtapose that that kind of imagery in your mind, that here you have this enormous wealth capacity generation, and in the middle of it you have the traditional owners. Majority of those people sitting in that prison are traditional owners on their own country, largely a lot of them are in their own country. I think that's a classic example of where there is this form of economic apartheid that has been the process of the attempt to undermine and dismantle Aboriginal society, not only from the genocidal practice of colonisation, but it's also been very deliberate in the way of excluding people from the economy. We're a very wealthy country, as we all know, and we have to ask ourselves also, why haven't we been able to solve many of the social and other health ills that we have in the community? Things that are have been solved in other third world countries. Our circumstances, some health areas, is equivalent to an underdeveloped country in that regard. So you have to ask yourself why. I think it continues, while the effort to change this is largely coming from the Aboriginal community, this scenario I'm describing is still very much prevalent.
Peter, I'm reminded by the conversation we had with Virginia Marshall recently and the conversations we've had with a number of other thinkers around the importance of integrity and truth-telling and really confronting some of the images that are part of colonisation to understand how we can do things better. You've said that without the development of an economic self-determination framework, Indigenous Australians will continue to be second-class citizens in their own country. Can you explain what you mean by economic self-determination?
Well, I mean the fact that what I've just described in terms of our current context is where we've come from, and I don't see that for all of the investment that going into currently and historically has gone into the Aboriginal welfare program, because that's what it is. It's a welfare program. Well, while we do need a kind of safety net measure to be able to ensure there is a developing equitable position in regards to normal citizenship, entitlement, rights and interests, I don't think that we will ever achieve that equity until such time as there is this economic self-determination, economic sovereignty, what I call. And I think that's essential. That's not only essential for the well-being of the Aboriginal community from a health and well-being perspective, but and also from a healthy economic perspective, but it's also about its impact on local and regional and national economies and the contribution that Aboriginal people can bring to the nation in respect to their contribution. And I think that there has to be some reconciling, some reconciliation, some economic reconciliation that is large part of the response in any formal settlement or arrangement between the nation state and the First Peoples. I think the question is that historically we haven't so far been able to achieve that, and we continue to lurch from crisis to crisis and failed attempts from failed attempts. I think the what we need to do is to now in this new developing kind of era of discussions of a formal settlement arrangement, particularly now that the new Labor government, since their election in May 21, have pronounced the nature of the constitutional reform and also the Makarrata, setting up the Makarrata Commission and then through truth-telling and then the treaty negotiations, is that we need to contemplate this question of what happens the day afterwards as a way of engaging the Aboriginal community in a in exploring what are the fundamental institutional reforms that need to happen. What are the structural reforms in both in terms of the infrastructure required, in terms of the programs required, things like the financial and fiscal particulars that relate to Aboriginal ownership and Aboriginal sovereignty of the nation, and how that is to be designed and interpreted within a formal relationship structure. I think that we have to look at precedences that might have been set elsewhere in the other, you know, First Nation experiences in colonized countries, in Canada, in New Zealand, and the US, amongst where we are familiar with some of those experiences, but also there are other countries we need to learn from about setting up those institutions that can work with Aboriginal corporations to deliver that form of economic independence and equity. But important in that is building the kind of governance and management framework and filling, breaching that capability gap, closing that capability gap that builds that degree of competence and experience for Aboriginal people to own and run their own affairs and businesses and to manage their own investments and to ultimately, I guess, manage their own risk in that regard. I think that's where we have to move to, but we're not there. We've got a long way to go, but there are important examples of where this is starting to happen. I recently spoke to one of our distinguished international guests from Canada, from the Harold Keller, the chairman of the Financial Management Board in Canada, set up under the Financial Fiscal Management Act there. And it's an attempt to help to drive this kind of economic independence and sovereignty in First Nation communities in Canada. And, you know, one of the comments he made was that in the repatriation in 1982 of the Canadian Constitution from the UK, one of the things that wasn't considered were issues associated with setting up the financial institutions and structures that would guarantee the nature of income and revenue and economic independence. And I think that that's a good lesson for us to contemplate and to understand and learn better how we might do that. So while we don't want to take away from the very particular propositions that are being discussed as to what might be put in a referendum in terms of setting up the voice, we have to think about this question of what happens the day afterwards. What are the suite of legislative reform measures that need to take place. That includes infrastructure, that includes structural change in terms of organisations that, again, you know, to be able to address this issue.
And that's a great spot for us to pause and perhaps give some thought to what happens the day after. We're going to take a really short break now and we'll be back in just a moment talking further about economic self-determination.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back, everyone. We're here with Peter Yu, and before the break, we began to talk about the critical importance of self-determination for Indigenous Australians. And Peter, this, of course, was the focus of a recent symposium hosted by you and by the First Nations portfolio here at the ANU, Maramaramura, or Creating Pathways. And we want to start to draw out some of the things that you talked about in that symposium. And of course, before the break, you mapped out so powerfully for us the kinds of policy failure, what you've referred to as a kind of economic apartheid, that has been ongoing in this country for many, many decades, really since the arrival of white people and the beginning of dispossession. And you've mapped out the trauma and the policy failure. Peter, before the break, you referred to the processes of truth-telling and a voice. And I wanted to ask you about how we begin to build trust as a way forward. Is the adoption of the Uluru Statement from the Heart the way to do that? And how do we begin to think about the day after the statement has been adopted to ensure that we keep building trust and can give Indigenous peoples an assurance that they can trust a system that has betrayed them so badly?
It's a very good question, Sharon, and trust is fundamental to all of this, and the whole purpose of the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the proposed constitutional recognition and establishment of the voice is the basis, it's the foundations of this trust, of this new trust moving forward. And I think it is a challenge for Australians to contemplate how that trust might be played out. But, you know, I think I get a sense of feeling that there is a growing sense of weariness in the Australian community about the fact that there hasn't been this trust, the fact that we've dealt with the major kind of deficit issues, and people are asking questions, and particularly younger population are asking the question, why is this necessary and why is this continuing to happen? So I think there is a sense of optimism, certainly from my perspective, that there is a growing need, and it's a kind of, I'm not a social media kind of person, but I think it's kind of ironic. While there are a lot of negative things, social media, I think, in fact, social media has really brought to bear some level of influence in respect to a greater exposure of the issues as they happen on a timely basis, that has brought ordinary Australians into the kind of situation that raises the question about this inequity and continuing injustice. You can't really get away with much these days without somebody having a camera rolling, photographing some particular instance that raises question without, and then followed by, hundreds of, if not thousands of comments about it, and which creates a kind of environment of question and challenge. And that's happened in the Aboriginal space as well in terms of our relationship. So, but notwithstanding that, I think that the demographics still remain the same in terms of the real lack of personal exposure to the Aboriginal kind of issues. It's not an Aboriginal problem. It's a national problem. It's a problem of the nation, and I think that's that. I think the referendum will clearly demonstrate that an Aboriginal leaders have said that, you know, we can't do it without you. You know, you need to stand with us in doing this. And but I think that, you know, since the 67 referendum, since all the major kind of policy and legal and political milestones that have happened in the last 50 years of public policy change, you know what? The sky hasn't fallen in, has it? Previous Deputy Prime Minister Fisher talked about bucket loads of extinguishment and talked about, you know, people talked about negative deficit scenarios that haven't occurred. The sky hasn't fallen in. Yes, that we have a complicated process to navigate in terms of the way that legislation is structured and the way that that is then manifestly transferred into action on the ground and to derive the appropriate, the right benefit from it. Against that backdrop, the sky hasn't fallen in, but against that backdrop, people are seeing the unacceptable levels of continuing incarceration and recidivism levels in our general Aboriginal population, and particularly also in the youth population. And there's been a lot of coverage about youth suicide. And I think that people can relate to that because that's also happening in mainstream society as well too, that we have the unfortunate case of many young people taking their own lives. And that's, you know, it's extremely tragic and has great sort of sense of emotional response from families and from others. And so it's not a black and white thing. The kind of sense of effect and influence and tragedy and emotion that comes with it, I think many people feel that today. So they can equate that when they see an Aboriginal situation. It's no longer at an arm's length situation where it's a them and us kind of a scenario. And that happens to various occasions at the time because we unfortunately, the other form of the, you know, social and other forms of media continue to play the kind of controversial issues as being the key kind of cover story of the day. But I think this is balanced by social media. So I think that the other thing is that there has to be government leadership in building that trust. There has to be, and I know that that has to fit within the kind of normal political cycles. You would imagine that in the current circumstances, as following the Labor government's commitment in relation to those, the Uluru Statement and the three key touch points arising out of that, that there would need to be, in all reality, those reforms in some way or not. The measures have to be accommodated within the first half of the current political cycle, so that, again, we have to convince the community that the world isn't going to collide and the sky isn't going to fall in. And in fact, it becomes part of our norm. But what we have to do is to also expose what the truth of the ongoing contribution that Aboriginal people can make. So to the economy and to the lives of other Australians. An example would be, you know, the new kind of developing green economy in terms of the renewables and offset programs. I mean, we know that we have a significant number of Aboriginal land and sea rangers that are managing, you know, caring for country, particularly through the kind of fire-burning methodology around the country, initially in the north with savannah burning, but now in the kind of right around the country, and Aboriginal groups, traditional owners in the south are doing exactly the same thing and doing some other fantastic work as well. You know, The idea that using the kind of customary knowledge base to engage with Western science methodologies, A, to protect the country within this hotly disputed area of climate change, but at the same time get an economic return from engaging in that, I think is an example of where we can demonstrate that not only are we the traditional owners and custodians of the natural estate, but we're also, you know, the custodians for the national estate on behalf of all Australians. I think that's the kind of example I think we should be exposing, and we should be marketing and saying that that's an example of a contribution to the well-being of the country and the environment, and how we're playing our part in relation to climate change. There are other ways of doing that in terms of managing biodiversity and looking at the question of biosecurity issues. There are those things as well, but as a kind of simple example, I suppose that's a way in which the trust can be built, you know, I think. But it's not going to be an easy sell, but I think it's happening.
No, I think we are really beginning to learn, and I hope as a country we're increasingly understanding the importance of celebrating First Nations knowledge, which has transformative power. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about compensation. Sir Tar Mark Solomon, a distinguished Maori leader who's been deeply involved in the process of securing compensation from the Crown in New Zealand to Maori peoples, asked the question about economic self-determination and economic empowerment. And I wonder if we can what we can learn in the Australian context from that economic compensation model in New Zealand.
Compensation is not a separate thing from the nature of economic empowerment, in my view. Compensation is a right that we have, given the kind of nature of our historical experiences and the atrocities. I mean, when George III provided those instructions to Cook in relation to treating with the natives, I think it was the term, and then we opted out of that instead of put in the repugnant notion of terra nullius, an empty country, nobody here, a clear lie, a clear mistruth, and something that has to be addressed, that is the foundation of the settlement of this country. That has to be addressed. It can't be. For the soul of the nation, for us to look at ourselves where we sit today and where we sit within the context of the global nature of our positioning with other countries, we have to deal with the truth of the issues, and that's what truth-telling is all about under the Makarrata Commission. But compensation forms a very large part of the reason why, and that's also not just the right thing to do politically, but it's also something that has now come to the fore as a result of the ongoing legal battles that have been had by Aboriginal people. Harold Calliffe made another comment when he said one of the key hereditary chiefs in Canada said, you know, after a number of different high court decisions, you know, gee, we're getting tired of winning all these legal challenges, which demonstrates that that's an ongoing struggle. I mean, if you look at Timber Creek, it's provided a new basis for quantifying the nature of impact on native title on other means other than just impact on land. And there are two now current cases, I believe, in the federal court. One is the Gumach claim by Galeri Yunupingu and his clan up in East Arnhem Land and Gove for the destruction of cultural and other sacred sites with the establishment of the bauxite alumina operations up there by Rio Tinto. And also there's a claim by a small group of Yungar people in the southwest of Western Australia in the federal court as well for compensation. I don't think they're directly related to Timber Creek, but what that does indicate is that there are growing there's a growing movement and interest of people. Governments in 1994 negotiations between Paul Keating and the Aboriginal leaders in regards to the Native Title Act, Keating indicated that the Commonwealth would pick up 70% of compensation claims and native title claims, and the states would carry 30%. I don't know that that's actually happened. But we've also had recent legislation in the Victorian Parliament with the Juruk Commission and setting up of the Treaty Authority, the independent umpire, to look at the question of the negotiations for a settlement in Victoria. And part of that is setting up a compensation well too. So we need how to quantify that compensation is going to be the interesting question. I've mentioned previously the lost opportunity and the necessity to contemplate compensation since our first settlement. There, of course, is under the Native Title Act, the impact of the interest of traditional owners on their lands, and that's compensation. You know, the question has to be asked, are we going to wait for further case law studies to be developed and precedents to be set in the High Court, or is the government going to look at what a political settlement might look like in terms of compensation? And compensation should be seen within the broader context of economic sovereignty, because the nature of any final settlement has to be in perpetuity. So the ability for the traditional owners to have an independent kind of revenue income base to be able to equally balance, to have the fiscal and financial equalization framework developed, so that there is a very specific recognition of what those entitlements are as it relates to our civic rights as Aboriginal people. Matters, they're not easy, but will need to be addressed, in my view. And again, what are the institutional framework look like that is able to maintain this in perpetuity?
Peter, recently at the symposium that we mentioned, the Muramuramura or Creating Pathways Symposium, you had a number of incredible thinkers and doers from across Australia and across Indigenous Australia. And I wonder if you could talk us through some of the initiatives that were discussed at that symposium, or that you see more broadly, that are currently playing out, and where we're seeing Aboriginal self-determination and Aboriginal sovereignty starting to take root or to steam forward, and that give us pathways forward. Are you able to talk us through perhaps a few examples that we could look to see how we might do things better?
Well, as I indicated previously, I think the a lot of the initiatives are coming from individuals, Aboriginal individuals themselves and their own businesses. I mean, Leah Armstrong from First Nations Capital, I think, is a classic example of, in terms of this question of access to capital, but how to kind of look at more the question of addressing the social licensing for impact investment strategies. I think there's still a fundamental need, I think, to mentor Aboriginal businesses in a way where we can develop the kind of acumen and expertise needed to do this. But some of the examples, I suppose, is, you know, come through the kind of Indigenous procurement policy position and the supply nation and the kind of the ability for Aboriginal companies to be able to access preferential tendering kind of processes. I don't have all the figures in front of me at the moment, but it's risen quite dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years.
Peter, this conversation has just raised, so many issues around where we see both deep policy failure, but also the need for fundamental change in relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia, and the extent to which that burden of change really falls to non-Indigenous Australians rather than shifting more burden onto Indigenous Australians to fix the problems that have been created. And as we think through and talk through those issues, I wonder whether we can achieve the kinds of change that you've been mapping for us within the kind of economic system that we have, or whether we really need greater transformational change, and whether we need an entirely new way of thinking that brings in far more fundamentally Aboriginal approaches or Indigenous approaches to thinking about the structure of our economy and the structure of our society. And I mean, that's a very big question, but I'd love to hear any thoughts you have on that. You know, can we tinker with the edges of what we've got, or do we need very broad transformation?
I think we need both. I think there are ways that we can tinker at the edge and make quite dramatic changes without any major legislative reform agenda issues. I think the current infrastructure we have is the Indigenous Land and Sea Corporation, which of course was established as one of the trilogy responses to the Keating government's response to Mabo 30 years ago, and also the Indigenous Business Australia. They're two kind of key national organisations. I think that there's also the land fund that comes with the responsibility of the Indigenous Land and Sea Corporation. I think they in 2018, I think it was, there were amendments to that act. And previous to that, you know, there was an annual drawdown from general accounts setting up the kind of fund, and it was roughly at about $2 billion over the last 40 years because it had been accumulating, you know, very minimal returns from government bonds at about 4% or something like that, until they changed the law and then put it into the future fund. And it's been driven home how successful that's been, and basically doubled its kind of return in the last four years compared to the last 40 years. So, you know, that's an example of a small tweak was required. I think the other thing was, for instance, similar to the model in Canada that I mentioned before, the Financial Management Board, or Fiscal Management Act, but the board set up under that act was the ability to, it's kind of an opt-in, opt-out from the normal Indian affairs legislation. So it's working with communities who want to take more of an economic development approach towards their business on their lands and their communities, and how they might want to activate and use their particular assets they've been able to accumulate post the native title and land rights kind of determinations. And a component part of that is the role of ORIC, the Office of the Registrar of Indigenous Corporations, which operates similar to ASIC here in Australia, and that is a regulatory kind of organisation that looks at the obvious compliance requirements, governance compliance requirements. Now, in the Canadian version, it's there. It's Australia's a deficit model, but in Canada, it's a more affirmative kind of supportive model where that works within the Financial Management Board and under the Fiscal Management Act, where it actually works with member communities and bands and groups who decide to opt into this process, to assist them with their developing and growing competency in the governance and management of their business. Whereas here in Australia, we have that deficit model where it's about penalising the nature of it. There are some training programs, I know that there are there, but they're minuscule and irrelevant compared to what you can do to the counter measure of being able to build that degree of competence in the organisation. So that's certainly, you can do things like that today. There's nothing stopping you. And there needs to be positive intervention by government, not at the moment. I think the policy position from the previous government was that economic development sits under the whole framework of closing the gap. Now, I don't think that's going to achieve any great kind of miraculous outcomes from that. That needs to be seen as a completely separate responsibility and task to be able to complete. But under that, the foundational issues go more back towards the kind of whole compensation, truth-telling and treaty requirements, because you can't have those processes happen and just fall back to the existing system that we have in place now. It would be unimaginable and intolerable that was to happen. You would need to frame this in a more modern and contemporary context that clearly defines what self-determination and economic sovereignty is about. And that is about the Indigenous institutional capacities to be able to manage and undertake these various things themselves. That's why you need to have foundational issues are very much part of it. You can do both at the same time. There's no problem. So I think that's what we need to be working towards.
Peter, this has been an extraordinary conversation. You have given us so much to think about, and I think so powerfully mapped the things that we can and should do immediately, as well as the longer term issues that we need to address as a matter of urgency. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your insights. It's been an absolute privilege to talk with you.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Anna-Greta, what an extraordinary conversation that was with Peter. I think he so powerfully outlines the ways in which we need to completely shift our thinking and the way First Nations peoples are positioned in Australia. We need to move beyond what Peter describes as that codependency. We need to move beyond thinking about a welfare approach, a deficit approach, to the kinds of new ideas that Peter lays out for us.
Sharon, I'm going to come back to the sorts of elements of hope that we've found creeping their way into the conversations we've had since the 21st of May and since our federal government here in Australia changed. And I feel like we can have these conversations. The conversation that Peter brought us, the ideas, are so fundamentally important to any notion of reconciliation with Indigenous peoples across Australia. They're absolutely essential to the conversations around the Uluru Statement. And yet I feel like the space to have these conversations is really just beginning to open. And I really hope that the listeners enjoyed this conversation as much as we did, and the ideas I know will percolate along in my mind going forward.
Look, I agree entirely. And I think about, you know, what we've spoken about before on the pod, Anna-Greta, is that very first sentence of Prime Minister Albanese's victory speech on the 21st of May, when he immediately spoke about adopting the Uluru Statement of the Heart in full. And I think that sets the scene for us to be able to talk in ways that are infused with hope and optimism. And I think Peter's point today is so important too. What happens the day after? And we are now at the days after. So what do we do, and how do we continue to act and to make this real? And of course, Anna-Greta, we'll keep coming back to some of these issues, but I think today's episode sets the scene for this mini-series so powerfully. When we are thinking about cost of living crises, when we're thinking about the ways in which the structure of our economy impacts on all of us, we also need to have front and centre the way in which it impacts on First Nations peoples. And if we don't do that, we will fail ourselves. We will fail as a country. So we'll keep having these conversations. We will have another episode in this mini-series next week when we're talking about issues around the impacts of the current crisis on health, on well-being, and on the health system. And Anna-Greta, I think you might be jumping the mic that next week. I'm looking forward to asking you some questions.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I think, Peter, you actually touched on a few of the issues that will no doubt come up next week, and I'm very much looking forward to that conversation.
This podcast is produced by policyforum.net, and we will leave a link to the publications and the sources that we've talked about in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And do let us know what you're thinking about the kinds of conversations we're having on the pod by leaving a review. We love to read them. You can find us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, that's at APPS Policy Forum, or you can email us at podcast@policyforum.net, or you can join our Facebook group, and you can find us by just popping Policy Forum Pod into the Facebook search bar. We will look forward to continuing these conversations next week, but from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
And from me, Anna-Greta Hunter, I look forward to seeing you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.